I'm Mike Asnald, and welcome to the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge's AC23 Plus Artist Legacy Series podcast. This is a series where we talk to artists who are doing amazing things in the areas of the arts, including performance, education, production, as well as arts advocacy. We record this series in the Virginia and John Nolan Black Box Studio, as well as in the Jan and Bill Grimes Recording Studio here at the Cary Siraj Community Arts Center. Be sure to visit artsbr.org for more information on all the great things we are doing here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. Hope you enjoy the podcast series, and thanks for tuning in.
All right, I'd like to welcome our AC 23 Plus listeners and viewers to another session. And Mike Asnault, Director of Arts and Education here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. And today I have I'm very intimidated today. I have a guy that I've admired for many years and has accomplished so much in his life that it's, I don't know if we have enough time to do this, but Mr. Jim Odom. Jim, thanks for being here.
You bet, Mike. Nice to be here.
We just had the pleasure of creating some music, literally creating it. We just composed some stuff. And
yep.
Before we get into it, I want to do try to do a proper introduction.
And okay.
You can just sit back, just take a nap, because it's going to take a while. No, but Jim is an amazing musician, guitarist, composer, producer, audio engineer, and of course an entrepreneur. You co-founded Personas back in 1995 with Brian Smith. Mm-hmm. Well, that company became a global leader in affordable digital audio equipment, and we'll talk more about Personas. But during that stint, you received the Incorporated 5000 Growth Award, mm-hmm. and many, many product awards with Personas. But other accolades, you're the recipient of gold and platinum records for various music and film projects, mm-hmm. including you co-produced music for the Dirty Dancing film, mm-hmm. Composed music for National Lampoon's European Vacation.
Yeah.
Love that movie. You're a member of the Grammys Producer and Engineering Wing, mm-hmm. NAMM, many other associations. I'm curious when I have guests on who are musicians, especially of your caliber, how did it start? Like, how did you get into music? What, did you come from a musical family?
No, I didn't.
Not at all.
I guess it came to me naturally. I think my grandmother may have done some, what they call it, radio production. So in the 50s, you know,
really?
Where radio production, meaning maybe she was a voice or a singer on a show or something, or, you know, a reader. I'm mm-hmm. not sure. I never really got the story there. But when I was about 10 years old, you know, I ended up with a guitar.
So it was guitar to start.
Yes. Actually, not true. I went to Catholic school, so it was a recorder.
right.
If you remember that.
Oh, yeah, of course. I went to Catholic school.
Yeah, so I started off with that. And I remember they wanted to graduate me to saxophone. I went, nah, I don't think so. My father had an acoustic guitar in a closet that he never played. So I took that over and started playing when I was 10.
Self-taught, essentially? Or?
For the first three, four years, yeah. I just picked it up. I mean, within a year, I was playing so much that my parents bought me an electric guitar. I used to, if you're from Baton Rouge, you'll remember it, there was a Kmart on College Drive.
Of course, yeah.
I used to ride my bike to the Kmart and look at the Tiesco guitars that had electric guitars up, and I'd go look at them. I don't know why. I'd go stare at them. So my mom bought me this guitar for Christmas, the one I would stare at. It's like probably a $200, $100 instrument.
Yeah.
But that really kicked off, you know, the interest in music. And, you know, I was deep into all kinds of music at the time. Luckily, my dad had a stereo and stocked it with all kind of vinyl, so I was putting anything and everything I could listen to.
To paint a picture of time frame, this is late
1973, 74.
Okay.
That time frame.
Yeah.
So hippie era.
Right.
you know, a lot of good music.
Classic time.
Started various music projects in high school. I was going to University High. And I became president of the choir in 10th grade by my I don't know how I got this title, but it gave me access and control of the Performing Arts Theater at U High. And I put on, like, we had rock operas, and we would have band lessons. We would teach people how to play instruments and play in a band. This is all in 10th grade. And then between 10th and 11th grade, I did a jazz, I guess it was a seminar with Lee Forche.
Oh, yeah, class, legend, yeah.
Yeah, at Baton Rouge High. Mm-hmm. And it was in the summer, and the drummer, George Clark,
yes.
and I played in the seminar, and Lee comes up to us afterwards and goes, "I want you cats in my band," is what he told us. And we look at each other
recruiting.
Like, exactly, what does that mean? You know, like we're being recruited to play football or something, because
right.
it kind of was back then. Band was a big deal.
Yeah.
So Lee calls my mom, "Hey, I'm Lee Forche, and I just got your son into Baton Rouge High. He's going to be leaving U High and coming to Baton Rouge."
Oh, so he's telling your parents.
He did. And my mom says, "Hey, I just talked to this interesting man who says you're changing high schools." I went, "Cool. Is that okay?
And was Baton Rouge High, was that kind of when it became a magnet school?
It was 1 year into the magnet program. So we showed up 1 year into that. And it was a really amazing place to be at the time.
Yeah.
Things like band, the arts, dance, of course, math, science were the stars. It was, right. wasn't athletics.
Right.
Right. So so we got to really focus and play. I mean, my schedule for my senior year in high school was, jazz band in the morning, jazz improv after that, and later on, quartet, and in between, I had calculus because I was into math and things. So I had calculus, right. pre-calculus, and science, which are other things I really liked. So.
Right. That was John Gerbrick there as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
John Gerbrick and Lee Forche.
Yeah. The dynamic duo.
Mr. Gerbrick was an amazing, wonderful man.
The two of those guys produced so many amazing students
they did.
While they were at that school.
Yeah, we had the players at Baton Rouge High were incredible at right. the time. It was a lot of competition.
Right.
So.
So you graduate from Baton Rouge High,
mm-hmm.
and then what comes next?
A week after Baton Rouge High, I moved to Boston and went to Berklee College of Music. I'd won a scholarship at the Loyola Jazz Festival, mm-hmm. which we played during the year. Downbeat Magazine gave me all-paid summer program
yep.
at Berklee. So I flew up to Boston a week after high school and started Berklee College of Music.
Hmm. With the intent of maybe getting a degree in music? Was that the idea?
That was the intent.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think more of the intent was to just get better on my instrument.
Right.
I really wasn't thinking degree in music because at that time I just didn't see it. What in my future?
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed one semester at Berklee, came back and started Loyola University in the fall.
Yeah.
And I played with the big band at Loyola.
Yeah.
And that was a really intense job because the band at Loyola was full of really amazing seniors, mm-hmm. juniors, and I had auditioned to get in. So it was a pretty rough job. As a 17-year-old, I wasn't quite 18. I think I just turned 18.
Yeah.
But it was fun. We used to play at the Saints football games.
Mm. No, was Joe Hebert part of
yes.
that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Joe Hebert was my band director. So I would drag my amp and guitar to the Saints games every Sunday and play in the corner with the big band.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was fun. And they had a book with 600 charts in it.
Yeah.
They would hold up a chalkboard, like 487, you'd find your chart,
sure.
you'd count it off.
Now, were you one of those, like I know with guitar players especially, a lot of guitar players, they just come to the music a lot of times from just the aural thing and not mm-hmm. so much more traditional. Were you one that enjoyed reading?
I did, but I couldn't read piano charts, that
right.
well, because they were kind of brutal for guitar. And so I'd get by just looking at key centers and kind of watching the changes,
right.
overall. But if it was a guitar chart, I could play it.
Yeah.
But a lot of times in the situations with big band, you get a piano chart.
Mm-hmm.
There's no chords on it at all.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so, but and those were rough. But other than that, yeah.
What do they say? It's smooth seas don't make skilled sailors, so you just got thrown into
right,
the trenches.
Is suck it up and go.
Right.
But that was, it was a fun time. But I stayed at Loyola only one semester.
And what made you leave?
I loved Loyola. It was a great college.
Yeah.
It was much different than Berklee.
Sure.
The approach to education, night and day difference, not even the same.
Right.
And so I just wasn't comfortable with the approach. It was more of a traditional music
right.
program, and Berklee was more, I guess you would call it commercial, or maybe a jazz.
Contemporary, yeah.
That's the word.
Yeah.
Contemporary. And so I decided to leave, and I go to LSU, which is where I wanted to go the next semester.
Mm-hmm.
And I started electrical engineering instead because I was curious about it.
Right.
Yeah. And so I did that for a semester. Then I went back to Boston to Berklee College again.
So you're figuring it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in that fall semester at Berklee, I met some amazing musicians, and we wrote a lot of music. came back from Berkeley, went back to LSU in electrical engineering, because I was like, I was figuring it all out. And I get a call from Louisiana's LaRue.
Yeah.
While I'm in college.
Legendary band. Yes.
Yeah, while I'm in college, engineering college. Because at the same time, we were recording music in a barn that I had turned into a studio that year. And we were recording a lot of music, and it was just a lot of music all around us. And I got a call. Jeff Pollard had left the band. Would you please meet us? I met with him, and I joined the band the next day. So it was really fast.
Wow.
And that began my professional music career.
So when you, okay, well, paint that picture for me. You joined LaRue, and what does that mean at that point? Are you, like, hopping on a bus and y'all are touring? Or
the first objective was to make the next album,
okay,
which was an RCA record. Mm-hmm. We signed with RCA. We wrote music for about 6 months, and then we went in the studio in the country for a month, or a month and a half, to record that album. Then we flew to Los Angeles for a month to mix it and do videos and things, and then we went on tour. So this was about a 4 to 5 month process before we, before we started really hitting the road, and then we hit the road for a year or two.
And were you pretty involved in the composition part of that album?
Yeah, they were a great bunch of guys, incredibly talented, and let me write. I wrote 4 songs on that album, which is pretty good for a brand new kid. I'm 23, and then the next guy above me was 30,
man.
I think, or 29.
Now, is that the album that had Carrie's Gone?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I wrote that song.
So that you wrote that
too? Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because that had some chart success.
Yeah, it did. We hit the top 40.
Wow.
With that one.
Yeah.
And the singer that we ended up hiring, we auditioned singer for 2 months in that process. And the singer we had, Fergie Frederickson.
Mm-hmm, of course.
Fergie and I wrote that song.
Yeah. Wow.
So.
Well, I'm curious, like, at that, in those stages of that time period, you're writing the music, but, I mean, mm-hmm. of course, you have such a deep background in, music equipment design and all that, and engineering. Like, were you involved in the engineering process of those albums at all, or mm-hmm. curious about it at that time?
Yes, very curious, because, as I mentioned, I had built a studio.
Yeah.
It was what we call 8-track, which is not a little 8-track. It's actually reel-to-reel with only 8 tracks in it.
Yeah.
And we'd built that, and the studio that we built was big enough to record a band, and it had 2 rooms, and I would tell my friends, as long as you bring your own tape, you can use it for free.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would buy tape, which was expensive. It was like $60 for a reel.
Right.
But I would engineer it. And this was pre-LaRue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we got into the process, I was just a sponge.
Right.
Our engineer, that was engineering that album, Warren Dewey was his name. Warren had done like Boston albums, Aretha Franklin albums, all kinds of stuff. So he was really well known. So I got to ask him a lot of questions.
Right.
Probably got tired of me. Yeah.
Well, those are the guys who end up going far, as the ones who are just
incredibly
inquisitive. Oh, yeah,
I pestered him to death. And we used to argue. I would argue with him. I don't know why. I was probably petulant little 23-year-old, Things like, I think that sounds too fat. And he goes, no, it's too thin. We would just argue about silly things, all the time. But I learned a lot from him. We mixed at Capitol Records in Los Angeles.
Wow. Yeah.
And so I spent a month there, which was an amazing experience.
One of the greatest studios in the world.
Right? It was incredible. Yeah. But, for orchestral things, one of the best rooms in the world.
I've been in that room once, just observing Alf Clausing scoring The Simpsons.
Yeah.
With an orchestra.
Yeah.
And I was just blown away.
Isn't it beautiful?
It's amazing. And then
another
thing that really grabbed me with that sort of thing is those LA musicians, how fast things moved. I mean, they just knocked that music out so fast, and it was like perfect.
Yeah.
But amazing studio.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things about Capitol Records building, it's at the corner of Hollywood and Vine, and the reverb chambers that they use for the orchestra are underground. They go under Hollywood Boulevard. So there's these big, giant rooms that are all mic'd up, and all the sounds for films and Frank Sinatra's records and all those records were the sound, the kind of sound of the hall came from those rooms underneath Hollywood.
Total natural reverb.
Right.
Yeah.
It's really, really neat.
Man. Well, so I know that at some point you go back to school, but how does that coincide with the whole LaRue career?
Like, so LaRue, we were touring. We had success with the album. It didn't make the top 30 or 40, you know, rock albums like I think the label wanted it to. And RCA Records at the time made a giant shift. Danny Loggins, Kenny Loggins' brother, was our A&R guy, and he was a wonderful guy, you know, really sweet to us, took care of us. But they got rid of him. They got rid of all the rock groups, and we were gone, too, off the label.
Okay.
Okay, so it's like, you know, time to change. What do you guys want to do? Do you want to go back and start writing and find a new deal? And I think kind of like the wind of change kind of hits, and it happened then. Tony Hazelton, our other guitarist, wanted to go write country music in Nashville. And he did really well. He had, I think it was somewhere around 60 top 10 records in Nashville. Yeah. Right. Five number ones. So he did real well in his career. He died last year. And, you know, I think Rod and myself and Fergie and David, Rod Roddy, wanted to do our thing a little different, wanted to go actually a little more rock than we were. And so we just, we split up. I went, I ended up not working with Rod. I ended up starting a new group with a singer that came, that was on tour with Kansas at the time, and myself, and David Peters.
Amazing
and so,
drummer.
And that was a band that did the closing track for European Vacation back in America.
Tell me a little bit about that.
We were, and this band only lasted 9 months, but we did a lot in 9 months. We
Sounds
were really
like
busy. It's called Network, and Phil Ehart, the drummer for Kansas, is a dear friend of ours, and Phil had a company called the Inside Track back then, and film companies or producers or whatever, directors would call him and say, hey, I need a song that sounds like X, I need a song that sounds like Y, you know, can you write it, can you send it out to your writers? So we were on that list of people, so he sends us the script to European Vacation, or it was script, I guess it was called Place, the
Like cue sheet, or
you know, it was the whole movie, right? So we go through the movie, we read it, and it said, we need two songs. We need an opening song and an ending song. So I think it was Fleetwood Mac or Mick Fleetwood got Holiday Road became the first song. Or third song. And they needed a closing song, and I wrote Back in America because I was at the end of that film. They're coming back to America, and in that plane, and, you know, and, you know, Chevy Chase walks up, and he trips, and he falls through the door, and he knocks the pilot over, and the jet goes down, and it hits the Statue of Liberty, and the arm goes
right.
Well, as soon as they, you know, right there is where they needed a song.
Right.
So I wrote this really big anthem, Back in America. You know, that's the closing track of that movie.
Right.
It was fun. We recorded it in Atlanta with Phil Ehart producing it, and then we mixed it at Sunset Sound in Los Angeles. You know,
That's impressive. I mean, you know, and at this age, what, you're at what age at this point?
20, Pardon?
You're, how old are you at this point?
I'm 64. Oh,
No. I mean when you were doing it.
Oh, sorry.
24 or something like that.
Yeah. 24 years old.
Man.
That was it was a nice moment, you know, for that band. And again, Winds of Change hit, and I got bored with the band. You know, all the guys, sorry guys, but I don't like this anymore. And I just got married, and I decided to move to Los Angeles to work with some friends of mine out there, which included Fergie Frederickson and just a bunch of guys that I knew from rock and roll days. And so we moved to Los Angeles, and I was playing guitar on like B movies and
right.
and playing jazz gigs on the weekends and just doing all kind of random stuff. Looking for work as an engineer, just kind of wanted to do that.
Right.
I applied to join UCLA's electrical engineering program, right, to go back to college because my brain just wanted to learn more. And they said, yeah, you're in, but we have a 3-year waiting list before you can start.
Oh, Lord.
You have so many people, you know, that were lined up, queued up to get into that college in electrical engineering. So I said, man, I don't want to do that. I got offered to go on tour with Belinda Carlisle.
Really?
With a friend of mine, and I just went, like, my wife was pregnant with our first baby, and I went, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
You know? Right. I'm not going to do that. So I packed up all my stuff, moved back to Louisiana, and started, you know, recording again and playing again, and like I said, teaching guitar lessons around here, and just doing anything I could in music and engineering, because I had a lot of work engineering at Studio in the Country.
You spent a lot. Well, for our listeners and viewers, I mean, Studio Country is a very famous studio.
Studio in the Country is in Bogalusa, Louisiana. It was founded by a guy named Bill Evans in about 1972, 73. I mean, Allman Brothers, Stevie Wonder, Rolling Stones, all kind of great albums came out of this
Paul
place.
Paul Simon, what did he do stuff?
Probably. Yeah, there is a lot of really great albums, and that's where we recorded. LaRue did. You know, 3 albums there.
Yeah.
And so it was just natural for me to start working there. So I started engineering.
Okay. There. So you're behind the board on
yes.
a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. Behind the board. Started engineering music, you know, albums, and that lasted for years. And in the middle of all that, I just started looking around the studio going, like, we just need different equipment for some of these things, you know. So I started designing, and I didn't know how, you know, technically I didn't have the chops, right? So that's when I went back to LSU, computer engineering, and did that until I finished college in computer engineering.
So once you finished that, like, what time frame would that have been?
It would have been 1989, 1990.
And you start Personas in 1995. So what's the lead up to that?
I was designing sonar systems for the Navy.
Okay.
Sorry. But there's a story behind it, right? My family has a company called Pyburn Odom Engineering at the time, and there was a spinoff from that called Odom Hydrographics that was no longer a family business but owned by a few people. And they manufactured underwater bathymetry, which is echo sounders, like depth finders. Yeah. Right, but it's a really fancy depth finder.
Right.
Okay, and I knew the chief engineer there, just had known him for years, and he talked to me. You know, I called him one day. Hey, I just want to know how's it going over there. He goes, "What are you up to?" I said, "Well, I'm in my 3rd year in computer engineering. I'm about to graduate. You know, next year." He goes, "Come see me tomorrow." So I went to go see him, and he said, "We want to hire you to start doing some just, you know, simple design stuff for us because we're short." I said, fine. So I started designing sonar systems, which is underwater sound.
Yeah.
So for me, it was just like audio underwater, right. You know, really what it was. It didn't look or feel any different. So funny thing is, right in my senior year, right when I graduated, he left. My friend that hired me quit. And they said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, what do you want me to do? I said, well, we want to promote you to head of R&D here. I said, okay. So right out of college, I started designing sonar systems. And we did, I designed underwater bathymetry systems for the Coast Guard. I designed underwater altimeter systems for the Egyptian Navy, all these really weird jobs. It's an oxymoron, but they have one. And then we were designing underwater like barrel location systems for the Kara Sea for one company, you know, north of Russia. And so I did that. I delivered papers to the Hydrographic Society and things. But the whole time, making music at night,
still
records on the weekend,
wow. Well, can you talk? I'm just curious, like,
yeah,
and maybe this question should come later, but
mm-hmm.
do you feel like your background as a musician, you know, the method of learning music, et cetera, especially the oral part of it and just the theory behind it, kind of parlays itself into just about everything you've done? Like from the, obviously, when you're designing music gear,
mm-hmm.
but also, well, even with the sonar thing, like just those, the sensibilities of being a musician, I'm mm-hmm. sure that really helped, right?
Tremendously.
Along with the knowledge of computer science.
Yeah, I guess it's how you frame the problem, you know, and I would look at like some of the underwater problems that we were solving, to me, were in living color, you know, the way I would look at it,
right.
You know. We were trying to find things on the bottom of the ocean. We're trying to find fish, you know, groups of seals, things that were underwater, you know. So it was a great job. I enjoyed
yeah.
it, you know, but you know, I got bored.
It seems like it would probably be a pretty good prep.
Completely. You know what? The best thing about the job was I was free to experiment, you know, and free to invent and fail,
yeah.
and then get it right and things like that. You know, I had a really great group of managers that I worked for, and they were really open to that, but we got things done. We definitely shipped a lot of product, but I learned about manufacturing because we built everything ourselves, you know, so it was a perfect precursor to what I was about to do.
Right. Okay, so let's dive into personas. So
mm-hmm.
at what point did you decide, did it start that sort of, was it that clear, I'm going to start an audio production company, or you just started building and then it evolved? I mean, how did that start?
It was pretty clear, honestly.
I guess you had to get into
this. I had a dream, you know, early, you know, in electronics that I'd be making music products because I just loved it. I loved the industry, and, you know, I liked helping the music production process mm-hmm. go easier. And so our first product came out of this. We would track in these beautiful million-dollar rooms. Then we'd have to mix sometimes on these consoles that were back in the 90s, early 90s, didn't have any digital anything. There was, you know, so there was no automation, you know, no automation systems.
Sure.
So our first product was a digital-controlled automation system for the cheap rooms. So what we wanted to do was bring some of the million-dollar ideas into the lower-cost studios.
Make them more affordable.
Yes.
Yeah.
And make them competitive with the million-dollar rooms.
Right.
Right. So in other words, you could automate, you can put compression and gating and all the different signal processing things you needed and not have to spend a fortune. Spend $1,500 and get a Mac computer, mm-hmm. and you can automate levels and you can automate everything, you
right.
know, so... That was our first intent, you know, was to solve that.
How big was the operation in the beginning? I know it was you and Brian Smith, but like how many?
Four
people?
Of us.
Really?
Yeah, the first 5-6 months, I think. I raised capital from several places,
mm-hmm.
including the Economic Development Group here in Louisiana,
yeah.
right down the road here,
yeah, right.
and they invested in our business and helped us get started.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I mean, from 1995 up until now, and now it's, you sold the Defender, but
mm-hmm.
so many products came from Personas.
Hundreds.
That I've had many of them. I mean, it's just from the mixers, the software,
mm-hmm.
Studio One.
Mm-hmm.
In that process, would you say that I'm sure you had to wear lots of different hats, you know, as a CEO, mm-hmm. and that was. But would you say the favorite part was always the creation part?
Yeah, it's interesting. Started off that way, and then I had to give up the creation process a little bit and be the manager, whether it's financial management or mm-hmm. you know HR, by you know doing everything myself. So. But then I got back into it later, mm-hmm. you know, into the creation process, and that's when, you know, we got deep into the digital mixers were a massive project. Very expensive, but we did it. The software group was started in Hamburg, Germany, by myself and two Germans. You know, I flew over there, and we co-founded a startup from ex-Steinberg people.
Yeah.
And we funded it, and Studio One came out 2 years later, and then we ended up acquiring 100% of that business, and that became Studio One Group, Persona Software Limited, out of Hamburg. Mm. And that's where Studio One came from. And now there's 60 people there, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, all engineers.
Were you pretty involved in the software side of things
Yes.
with that?
Yes. Yeah. Spent a lot of time, a lot of late nights, a lot of pizzas.
Well, I mean, take me through that a little bit. Like, so, like, at the time, what would already been around? Was, like, Digital Performer still around
yes.
yet?
Yes, Digital okay. Performer,
Cubase,
Pro Tools. I don't think Ableton was a thing really big yet, but I think those were the top three. And eMagic, which became Logic.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I think that was it. Of course, everyone told us we had lost our minds, you know, what are you doing?
Because the market was...
The world doesn't saturated. Need another digital right. audio workstation. And we said, you're probably right, you know, but we do. We need one.
Right.
Presonus needs one.
Right.
You know, and we think we can add value in ways that the others don't. And so we just kept plowing through it. And our goal, and it's funny, Wolfgang Kundrus was one of the founders, and I said, Wolfgang, so what are we going to do that's different, better, or what are we doing? He goes, we're going to take features away. We're going to strip it down to the simple process of recording. Plug it in, hit record, bam. You know, it's become very complicated. So our goal was drag and drop, simple, just open it up, but very professional, you know, from the point of, like, if you want to think about, you know, recording audio and actually doing it engineering-wise on a very high level, it was as good as anything. Wolfgang, do you remember Nuendo? That's
yeah.
all? Okay, yeah. Wolfgang had invented Nuendo
okay.
from nothing. So he was already extremely well respected.
Right, right.
So we were, you know, we were just inventing, really, from thin air at that time.
Right.
And, but the key was we had all this hardware that we had designed, and I wanted to integrate the two elegantly, you know, not cumbersomely, you
right.
know, just make it elegant. And we did that, I think.
You right.
know, we added recording features to a digital mixer that was less than $2,000 in, you know, whatever that was, 2010, I think, 11,
mm-hmm.
very new. And the whole idea for that was to give an engineer, you know, front of house engineer, a local club guy, the ability to ask the band, hey, do you want me to record your show tonight? Sure, how about $50 for that? Okay, here's your $50. Well, we just gave the engineer a way to make a little more money. That's honestly was the reason I wanted it. To give those guys a little bit more
right.
reason to, you know, to make, you know, use of our product.
Right.
So,
I mean, is it fair to say throughout the whole time you were there, which is the majority of the time, that was kind of the barometer, like whatever y'all are making,
mm-hmm.
it's to allow or to target that particular market of,
yeah.
you know, yeah, not the $1 million studios, mm-hmm. right?
It was never our target.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because that's the target you're judged by. But we never cared, and I still don't care. You know, it's like I always joke with my wife, we're out at, you know, some pizza place, and a guy drags his little rig in, he starts playing acoustic guitar, and she goes, oh, I don't know about him. I said, I love him. She goes, why? He goes, he's my people. He's one of me. He's one of us.
Right.
He's going to make like maybe $50 tonight and get a, you know, a free beer out of it.
Yeah.
But that's my guy. You know, maybe I can make something to make his world a little better. You
right.
know, that was always our mission.
Well, I mean, I can speak from myself. I mean, mm-hmm. for years of kind of composing stuff for documentaries and whatnot, just that I used your gear.
Like, well, yeah.
But it wouldn't have been possible. you know, years before.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that was the goal. That was the mission. And I think we did pretty good getting there, you know.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, so at a certain point, like how did the whole, or when Fender kind of came into the picture, were you at a point where were you looking for a change at that point, or what did that look like?
So we had venture capital money, mm-hmm. not really pure venture, I wouldn't say. It was more private equity, local private equity. And we had people that had been with us for almost 30 years at that time. I think everybody was a little fatigued, and seriously, some of our early shareholders had died, you know, and their families were sitting there going like, well, what's the company going to do? So you get to the point where, well, should we try to repurchase the stock from everyone and, you know, and build and bring it back into the business, or should we sell the business, you know, or merge, you know, is what it's called in the industry. And so we decided to position the business to see. We didn't need to sell. Mm-hmm. The company was doing fantastic.
Right.
You know, during COVID, we sold more product than we'd ever sold in our history. It was just really incredible.
Right.
Incredible how many products we were moving to over 190 countries at that time. It was just incredible. And so we said, okay, as a board of directors, let's see. Let's find an investment bank that has knowledge of this industry, and let's ask them to analyze this for us. Maybe go out, ask a few, you know, maybe interested parties, and see if there's any interest in our business. Well, we got 80 private equity and like companies and individuals is an incredible amount.
Right.
And so we said, okay, well, let's just keep working this, work it down to 40, down to 10. And then down to 5, and then down to 3 interested parties. We just kept whittling them down, you know, pricing and whatever other concessions we were looking for. And Fender Musical Instruments at the time was always the best looking choice. I mean, they had they understood our business from a musician level.
As a young musician, did you use Fender products?
Yeah, of course.
Right.
I think my second, third guitar besides the Kmart thing was a Fender Strat,
right.
You know. So, so they just, you know, from a just a management kind of glue, you know, structure. Did we get along? And also financially, they were the best the whole time. And everything they offered just looked like, yeah, we should do this.
Right.
We should merge the business. It'd be good for the shareholders. It looks like it's going to be good for the employees. They get to be with other musicians around the world, and you know, and let's do it. So that's kind of how it went down.
Yeah,
you know, if did not look right, we would not have done it.
Right.
So.
Yeah. So when that happened, you remained for
2.5 years.
Right.
Yeah, as VP of products, as related to all the audio side of the business.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So does that bring you more into, like, did that role make you more in the creative phase, or?
Yeah.
It did, okay.
Well, you know what's interesting? My job really was merging things like the R&D groups, mm-hmm. the product management groups, whatever other groups in the businesses. I mean, we had about 140, 150 employees. They have 4,800 employees, you know, so it was a huge business.
Right.
So their groups were very corporate, organized cells of people. And so if you want to take the engineering group and merge it into engineering, it was a process that took 2 years. Mm-hmm. You would think it would happen fast, but it didn't. It took time,
right,
and effort to place people. So
yeah,
once that was done, 2.5 years later, the head of the department I was in said, hey, the board was talking the other day, and we think it'd be a good time for you to retire. would you want to retire? Like, it was either a question or a statement. They said it like a question, and I said, well, tell me what that looks like.
Right.
And they explained to me, you know, this is what it looks like. I went, I'm tired.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Right.
It'd been 30 years, you know, and the process of merging was pretty tough. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, we were talking prior to recording.
Mm-hmm.
Just the, I'm just curious. Like when you're involved in something like that, I mean, surely the stress levels are
intense.
Get ridiculous.
Ridiculous at points. Yeah. Well, you know, you can't. The stress really happens not towards the end. And honestly, those were less stressful times. It was more stressful during the years. You know, 9/11 was massive stress, for example. You know, Katrina was a massive stress.
Mm-hmm.
There were just times in the business where we had to let go of people, and it's brutal, but it's part of the process, you know. And
that's the one thing that we, I know you thought about it constantly, but I'm putting it together. Like, it's not like you're running a business for yourself. You have so many employees that you probably feel very responsible for.
Very responsible for.
Yeah.
You asked me about one of my favorite parts of the business is over 25 years, we had funerals and weddings and graduations, and you wouldn't believe, just like a big church family almost, you know?
Right.
You get so many lives that you were responsible for.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Career choices and all kinds of things.
Well, I know many of my friends, musician friends, you know, I'm thinking of Rick Nockfe.
Yeah.
Like, had just had an incredible career with
Rick has had an incredible career. He's
Thanks
got a fantastic career right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, kudos. Kudos to you and Brian.
Yeah.
Oh, well, so you decide to leave, and what's been going on? What I kind of know. So you kind of started. You obviously are a very you can't sit still kind of guy, and you're a creative guy. So you started basically a new record label, right?
Yeah.
Miracle.
Miracle spelled MIRICAL.
Right.
Kind of a silly name. It came to me like in 2 seconds when I needed a website that didn't exist.
Well, so tell me about that. I know you have Jonathan Boogie Long on it.
Yeah. So our first release is next week, about end of next week. And honestly, I didn't plan to have it wasn't something I was thinking to do. It's like a lot of things, you know. I didn't wake up and go, man, I'm going to start this label. A really good friend of mine in Los Angeles says, okay, so which insanity drug did you take to want to start a record label,
right.
You know? And it's like, and it came down to this. Jonathan and I, Boogie Long, we met and with a mutual friend, and he said, you know, John is such a talent.
Super talented guy.
Yeah. He's just amazing. He really is. And he's so natural as a musician.
Right.
Perfectly just simple and natural and plays like a dream. And it was like, well, okay, I'm bored. Again, so let's go in the studio and just see if we have anything, you know. Write some songs. Mm. What do you got? He sends me a bunch of songs. We pick five, and then we pick five more, and we pick five more. We narrow it down, and we do a first 2 days of sessions in the studio, and it sounds really good.
Yeah.
You know, I'm using David Ellis, Terrence Higgins.
Yeah. Doug Below. You mentioned Doug.
Yes, and Doug Below. And Alan Maxwell, and then we had Papa John.
John Gross.
Thanks, John Gross. Anyway, and Nelson Blanchard, my friend, played.
Yeah, of course.
And so it sounded really good. I said, okay, let's keep going, you know? So we keep working. We finish the album, and I have a friend of mine in Los Angeles mix it. I could have mixed it myself, but it's been 10 years. I just wanted somebody else to do it. And my friend that mixed it, Daryl Thorpe. Daryl did Foo Fighters and Beck and a whole bunch of big bands. And so, he was on the Studio One Advisory Board, a really dear friend.
Yeah.
He did a fantastic job. We master it at Ocean by Michael Romanowski in San Francisco. It sounds amazing. Great record. My friend in Baton Rouge did the artwork for it. They did a fantastic job. Guys that I used for Personas.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, John, we got this great-looking CD. What are we going to do with it now? That's like step one of about 100 steps, you know, when it comes to a music career, right, or music production or making a product. So honestly, I said, okay, guys, here's the skinny. I've been making products since I was in my 20s. Let's just go through a product launch process with this. What does that look like, right? So, you know, if it's a product, this is what I would do, you know, and it came down to, okay, I need a PR person. I need some social media people to help me actually, you know, manage and create a market, which is a group of people that share ideas, you know. So I started building the market, started building the press, and I need an entity to put all this in. And that became Miracle Records,
right,
which is Miracle Media LLC is what the name of the company is. Because I realized later that I needed to name it something more like, you know, Bayou Boulevard Records or something like that, but that's, I got to that too late. But so we, you know, we started this process where a year and a half into it, I think, and explaining to Jonathan Boogie Long that it's a marathon launching anything. It takes time for people to notice, and it takes repetition.
Sure.
And it takes a great product. And you're a great artist.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so let's just keep at it.
Yeah.
Let's keep going. We have sold out twice now of our pre-CD sales.
Right.
We've had to make two reorders. So by the time we launch the end of next week, we might be in the top 10, 15 on the blues charts, something like that.
That's
I'm
amazing.
Not sure. But we'll see. If we don't, not worried about it. We have more things coming.
Right.
Collaboration with a very famous guitar player right now. We just started it today. I'm not sure if I can say it, who it is, because it's not inked yet, but
sure,
very, very top 10 in the world kind of guitar player.
Yeah.
And so we're going to do that. You know, we're just going to keep building. And at some point, you know, I'll realize that either, you know, we start to back away or we accelerate a little more, you know. But it's just of course, it's music to me.
Right.
It's gear and it's a product.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, I will say, well, a couple of things. First of all, he's very lucky to have you, and you know, behind to be the backbone of all that.
Thank you.
You know, just all that experience. But,
yeah.
But also, I'm really happy to see, like, physical music presented in a physical way, you know, CDs, and we had mentioned LPs, you know, just, I don't know, there's, you know, we're older, but that was just such a beautiful time when that was sort of the medium, you know, the norm, especially LPs.
Can I tell you a funny story?
Go ahead.
This is so funny. George Clark, Jim Odom story and high school story. Baton Rouge High, we played Mr. Forche, was our band director. We were playing, the band would play these concerts. We were playing this concert for probably some old folks' home somewhere, right, high school band. And the Rush Hemispheres album had come out that day. And so Mr. Forshey says, okay, guys, be back here in an hour. We got an hour break. So I said, you know, I just bought this album. I said, dude, let's run to my house and listen to the record. So we go to my house during this break.
Y'all are on a gig.
Yes. And an hour turned into an hour and a half listening to this album. We were so amazed musically by it. And we look at each other. Oh, no. We go back.
I can't imagine.
We go back and Mr. Gerbrek's son, Jed Gerbrek, is playing drums. And Mr. Forche just wouldn't even look at us. We go and I pick up my guitar and I slink back in my chair. And I start playing the rest of the rest of the gig, you know.
That's classic.
Oh, it was so classic, funny, stupid high school
stuff. But it was worth it. I mean,
oh,
that's
man,
a hell of an album.
We got to listen to that record. We just couldn't stop listening.
Right.
The funny knucklehead story.
Man. Well, Jim, you know, I could pick your brain for another 3 hours, but I know you have things to do. But I'm really honored, man, that you
thanks, Mike,
and agreed to do this, you know.
And your career has been amazing too, by the way.
Oh, well, well, thanks for noticing any of it.
Yeah,
but
I've noticed.
No, I appreciate
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great to play music with you.
Yeah.
And you know, just wishing you all the best, man.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge would like to acknowledge our generous sponsors, the Shell Corporation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Louisiana Office of Cultural Development, and the City of Baton Rouge.